Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Thursday, June 15th, 2017, starting just after 1:36 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 112th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Chet Zdrowski about the life and work of the famous 20th century astrologer Dane Rudyard. Chet, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to come back. So we actually recorded this episode originally a couple of days ago on Tuesday the 13th, but we suffered a technical malfunction that forced us to lose. We lost half of the show. So we're actually re-recording it again today. So thanks for bearing with me on that in order to come back and try to talk again about this important topic.
Great. Well, we'll make it memorable.
Yeah. I mean, that was the part that sucked the most, was that it was actually a really great discussion. So I'm glad we're giving it a second shot, because I think it's an important topic and an interesting topic. And yeah, it should make for a memorable episode. So let's jump right into it. So we're talking about Dane Rudyard, who was a highly influential astrologer who lived between 1895 and 1985. So his life and his career spanned for almost a century, and his period of activity was from, in the astrological community, was from the 1930s through the 1980s, and he became one of the most influential astrologers of the 20th century in setting the foundations for much modern astrological practice. But not everybody often realizes how influential he was. And Rudyard is somebody that you've studied for quite some time, right?
Yes, I have, actually. He's really quite fascinating. And there's a lot of material. I think we were discussing that the other day. He has around 50 books that he wrote in his life, and lots of articles. So there's a lot of material, and at least 30 of those books were astrology books. Now, with Rudyard, he had philosophy books, psychology books, you know, but a lot of those had a lot of astrology also. So there's a lot of material there.
Right. He was a very prolific author. And I think one of the things that we kind of realized when we were talking the other day is that he was probably one of the most prolific astrological authors ever or in history, as far as we can think about. Because I'm trying to think back of anybody who's written more books than Dane Rudyard, and I'm actually struggling to think of anybody. I really can't think of anybody that's as prolific as Rudyard was during his lifetime. I mean, can you think of anyone else?
Well, we went through a list the other day, and I don't think we came up with anybody who was probably even half of that.
Yeah, it's like Alan Leo wrote a bunch of books, and Mark Edmund Joan wrote a bunch of books, and there's other authors who wrote, you know, a collection of like a dozen books is usually like a lot of books in terms of a single astrologer, but you know, Rudyard writing 30 plus astrology books just kind of blows everyone else out of the water. So he's a hugely prolific author, and in order to understand Rudyard's place in history, you kind of have to contextualize what astrology was coming out of. So astrology died out essentially in the West in the 17th century and reached a kind of low point where it wasn't really being practiced much in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th century. And then later, towards the end of the late 19th century, it started to be revived in the late 19th and early 20th century, especially via the Theosophical Society and the growing New Age movement. So astrology was revived as part of this sort of growing interest in sort of, you could say, occult or New Age or alternative spirituality type movement that was happening in the West, and astrology started playing a large part in that. And what's interesting is there's usually three figures in the West that are often credited with both the revival and popularization and modern reconceptualization of astrology. And the first is Alan Leo, who, especially at the very turn of the 20th century, at the very beginning of the 20th century, wrote a lot of very influential astrology books in English, some of which were translated into other languages and that were spread about and really helped to revive and popularize astrology again, the practice of casting birth charts and other types of astrological charts. So you've got Alan Leo in the early 20th century, then Mark Edmund Jones is another pivotal figure. And then finally, the third is Dane Rudyard. But the interesting thing about Rudyard is that his period of activity spans all the way from the 1930s through the 1980s. So he's this really interesting middle figure or sort of transitional figure during this very crucial time when astrology was revived in the West, but then also when it sort of exploded in popularity, especially in the 1960s and 70s with the younger generations coming in and the hippies and the counterculture movement who got very interested in astrology. And then they found this very deep thinking astrologer, Dane Rudyard, who had been writing dozens and dozens of books since the 1930s. And at that point, his popularity just took off even more. And so that was actually the point at which you found him, right? Was in the 1960s and 70s?
Right. Those were certainly some of the first serious astrology books I ran into. And they were amazing. I mean, you know, there were Rosicrucian books and coffee table books, but you know, what he was doing was on a different level entirely. And it was pretty impressive. His timing was wonderful because, you know, in the 60s, there was this explosion of interest. And there was Rudyard with all of this material. He was 70 at that point, but he was pretty darn vigorous. And, you know, he had a lot to do with spreading astrology at that point. And Alan Leo did not have that situation where there was that kind of mass possibility that Rudyard had.
Right. And it was kind of, you know, Rudyard represents, whereas Alan Leo was, you know, certainly pushing astrology towards more sort of character analysis and less, you know, concrete prediction of events and things like that. Rudyard really was one of the first true psychological astrologers in some sense. And he was really like a thinking man's astrologer because he was often trying to go back and look at the basic techniques and take them back to first principles so that you could figure out what the underlying philosophy of all of the techniques are first and then work out all of the details from there. So I'm sure there was something about Rudyard that would have been really appealing, especially compared to his contemporaries, because he had that very, even though he had a spiritual and a sort of philosophical sort of backdrop or approach, it was also just very well thought out and kind of intellectual in some sense, right?
Absolutely. It was very impressive at the time and still is.
Right. So, you know, while Alan Leo, while Rudyard can't be attributed the popularization of astrology in the same way that somebody like Alan Leo could in the early 20th century, Rudyard really is probably one of the most, if not the most pivotal figure in establishing the philosophical and conceptual foundations of modern astrology in the 20th century. And most of the things that modern Western astrology has turned into today often can be traced back to Rudyard, sort of setting a foundation for that in sometimes either very subtle or other times very overt ways. And that's actually important because sometimes one of the points you've made in the past is that many astrologers today have often been exposed to his ideas and different philosophical and conceptual premises that he first outlined without necessarily knowing that they originated with him because they've become so ingrained into the astrological tradition. And so many later authors after Rudyard adopted and read his works and were influenced by them that they became kind of like commonplace ideas that have then been sort of filtered down over successive generations at this point, right?
Right. And it's great to have those ideas there. It's beautiful. I've had some friends that have said, you know, it's kind of funny. His ideas are all around in modern astrology, but, you know, a lot of people are just basically forgetting his name at this point, so I welcome this opportunity. This is great.
Yeah. All right. So let's do that with this episode and let's give an overview of his life and work and help people to sort of understand what a crucial figure he was, why his work was important and why it's still interesting and sort of relevant and why the ideas that he outlined still demand, you know, some attention today from astrologers, no matter what tradition you're coming from. So Rudyard was born actually in the late 19th century, right?
Right, right. He was born as Daniel Chenevier in 1895 in Paris. He was born into a middle-class Catholic Parisian family. He called them very bourgeois. His father owned a small factory. So in his early years, they were pretty well off. Not fabulously so, but it was very middle class. And young Daniel had an interest in music and in the piano and in reading. He was a pretty voracious reader. But he also had a lot of health problems. I mean, the list is kind of impressive of health problems in his youth. But the worst one being when he was age 11, he lost a kidney and an adrenal gland. And at that time, they thought that if you only had one kidney, you were going to have a very short lifespan. And that didn't turn out to be the case in case for Rudyard. He lived to age 90 and was pretty good health overall. But because of this, all these medical problems, he had a lot of homeschooling. And he was a very bright person and he could absorb a lot. So homeschooling would work out okay for him, you know, but losing the kidney turned out to be something of a blessing in that he didn't get drafted into the French army in World War I, which his chances of dying would have been really, really high. So this was a case of something that was a difficulty, but also a bit of a blessing. And his reading list when he was a teenager at home in convalescence in homeschooling was pretty impressive. Read all of Nietzsche, Freud, Bergson, Plato, most of the Platonists. I mean, this was quite a reading list for a teenager.
Sure. So he was very widely read as a youth, partially due to these health issues and due to the homeschooling. And so from very early on, he learned how to do that sort of research and how to read widely and have a sort of expansive scope in terms of his philosophical and sort of metaphysical understanding of the world.
Right. But he probably wasn't going outside and playing with the other kids quite as much. But he made up for that with books, I guess. At age 16, his favorite uncle passed away. And a couple of months later, his father died, which, of course, you know, turned the family upside down. It was pretty upsetting. And you know what often happens when people go through crises or great difficulties, sometimes they have, you know, major insights, major epiphanies. And he said that during that period, he had this, you know, this, I don't even want to call it a satori, something like that, something you remember your whole life. And he understood the cyclic nature of the world, that everything worked in circles and cycles, and he could see it everywhere. And he had a vision of the old world. You know, the European society was starting to go into its autumn. And he thought about the new world, and he thought that it was just entering its springtime. And it's almost as if there was, you know, at that point, he kind of had some maybe subconscious decision to move to America. He really viewed that as a whole different part of the cycle. And this idea of cycles was huge to him.
Right. That became his core underlying philosophy. And that sort of was sort of spread around or became central to almost all of his astrological work later as an adult, right?
Absolutely. That was probably the core thing. And you know, the other day you gave a really nice description of the archetypal cycle. And, you know, how would you explain that?
Yeah. So, I mean, because, you know, this is something where instead of putting that discussion off till later, maybe we could just have it here just because this is so core and it's so interesting that he wasn't into astrology at this point, but he still remembered later in life having this first epiphany about the cyclic nature of the world at the age of 16 after the traumatic loss of his father and his uncle. So, you know, he later, when he would get into astrology, when he tried to get to, you know, he would come across the books and, you know, there would be different significations, like the meanings of the signs of the zodiac or the meanings of the 12 houses or the meanings of the aspects. And he tried to look underneath all of that in order to figure out what the core underlying principles that all of that was deriving from. And the conclusion that he eventually came to is that all of those things had to do with cycles and that you couldn't just look at everything. Like most of what we were doing in astrology and looking at those individual significations was looking at their individual meanings within the context of the broader cycle. And that if you understood that and if you understood it and looked at it from the broader perspective, you would understand all of the different manifestations within the cycle. So for example, I think he started with the zodiac and that reconceptualizing the zodiac as the starting point of a cycle that begins when the sun passes over the vernal equinox at Aries and then has different sort of important turning points during the course of that cycle, like when the sun hits the summer solstice or when the sun hits the fall equinox or eventually the winter solstice, and those being the starting points in the tropical zodiac of the cardinal signs. And that everything within that is just, within the zodiac is just a subdivision of those cycles that have specific properties or qualities, essentially, right?
Excellent. Very well put. Yes.
Yeah. So on the one hand, that became his access point for understanding the signs of the zodiac, was understanding it in terms of cycles of development. But then he took that concept and applied it to the houses and said the houses are also just a type of cycle of development that starts with the ascendant and then moves counterclockwise around the chart through the successive houses. And each of those different houses just represents a different, almost like a slice of the pie within the overall context of the pie as a whole. And that each phase of that has different qualities because of where it falls within the overall cycle as a whole. And then eventually he applied that to the aspect doctrine as well, and to the doctrine of aspects, that it starts with the conjunction and then it moves around the successive aspects through the sextile, the opening sextile, then the opening square, then the opening trine, and then the opposition, and then there's the closing trine or the waning trine, the waning square and the waning sextile before eventually it comes back at the conjunction. And that you could understand the aspect doctrine as well as just studying a whole cycle, and that each individual aspect is just one part of that cycle, and that's what you're really trying to get to with the individual significations, essentially, right?
Right. Well put. Very well put. Yeah, and there's an archetype to how the cycle works. And then part of his key idea also is the idea that every cycle creates seeds in the second half of the cycle. There's some kind of seeds. He very much used the vegetative cycle to illustrate this. So there are seeds, that some of which will germinate in the next cycle. And there's always residues. You know, he would sometimes just say, well, there's, do you want to be the seed or do you want to be the humus, right? So there's both of these things. And, you know, this basic insight, it's rare to see somebody come up with such a strong insight at that early age and have it go through their entire career.
That's right. And in terms of the vegetative cycle, what did you mean about that? Or like in terms of the zodiac, for example?
Well, I mean, I think you can more immediately apply it to the lunar cycle, but the idea that, you know, things germinate at the beginning of the cycle and they grow. Yeah, exactly. A foundation is made, and it's as if a plant is growing. And at the first quarter, you know, it's big enough that it could get eaten by squirrels. It could be, you know, it could get eaten by pests. It has problems. It meets resistance. But then it keeps growing, and it reaches a flowering stage at the full moon, at the opposition. And then it starts creating a fruit and seeds. And those seeds can come out in the next cycle. So this image of the vegetation cycle is really core to what he was doing. And he could apply that in a lot of places.
Sure. And that brings with it ideas of like youth on, you know, on one side of the cycle versus like maturity on the other side of the cycle, and all sorts of other sort of connections and underlying meanings and metaphors and things.
Exactly. There's a lot of places we can go with this. And in fact, later on, we'll go there.
All right. Brilliant. Well, yeah. So that's really one of his core underlying philosophies and contributions to astrology, was reconceptualizing it within that context of cycles. And it's very striking that he had that first epiphany, not in an astrological context, but there was some inkling of that very early in his life at the age of 16. So,
yes.
But he also, as you said earlier, he was very into music, and that was really, I think, his first love, right?
Right. Actually, and he spent a lot of time playing the piano, composing music when he was young. And at age 17, he wrote a book about Debussy, which was very well received, very well reviewed. I read somewhere he may have even met Debussy.
And that was a famous composer, right?
Yes, he's probably one of the most famous French composers, romantic composers from around that time, the turn of the century. And from age 17, for the next few years, he spent a lot of time in Paris in avant-garde music circles and learning a lot, playing a lot of music, composing. But he still had this idea in his head that, you know, somehow he was going to end up in the New World. So at 21, an uncle of his died and left him a few thousand francs, as he said. So he got on a boat with a couple of friends and they sailed off to America. And he arrived here in 1916 in New York. And a few thousand francs was not going to go that far. So after he got settled a bit, he started living the starving artist archetype. You know, trying to find a way to keep himself afloat. He said he was walking around with pennies in his pocket. It really was that archetype. He found work doing music copying because in those days, you know, you had to do all this by hand. And he was very good with music notation. So a lot of composers, New York musicians were getting him to copy scores, which he would do in his basement apartment. He did house concerts, which was especially for serious kind of music, which is what he did. You know, they didn't really happen in concert halls mostly. It mostly happened at house concerts. And he did house lectures. He was very bright. Apparently people wanted to listen to him. But New York winters are very hard. You know, it was quite cold and he didn't have money even for heat in his apartment. So he'd be sitting there working with gloves on. And he said he developed the habit of going to the New York City Library to get warm.
Okay.
And that had just been completed for a year or two. So it was a nice big new library. And he just dove into the philosophy and spirituality section. And he read all kinds of Indian classics. He was introduced to Buddhism, all sorts of, as he said later, occult and metaphysical topics. And in 1918, he decided to change his name. He changed his name from Genevieve to Rudyar. And this, I guess in his research, he ran into something about the Vedic god Rudra. And he was the god of storms and disruptions. And Rudyar was the sun sign Aries, so I guess he identified with storms and disruptions.
Interesting.
He did pick a first name, Dane. And I believe someone had told him he had to have a first name for legal reasons. And I don't know if that was even true or not. But it's close enough to Danielle that, you know, without being Dan, so he'd be Dane. But hardly anybody called him Dane in his life. I mean, all his wives, friends, everybody would call him Rudyar. And he would on his books, it would say Dane Rudyar. But if you just were to say, hey, Dane to him in the street, I don't know that he would even turn around.
Interesting. All right. So he's sort of going through this whole, you know, interesting phase at this point, having just moved to the US, living in New York, going to the public library and continuing his just extensive reading, moving into, you know, philosophical thought and reading, especially about Eastern philosophies at this point, and still primarily being, you know, music being his primary thing, at least work-wise at that point. But then eventually at some point that changed, right?
It kind of gradually changed. He got a commission to do a score for a play in Hollywood in 1920. So he crossed the country and worked on this play, did the score. While he was in Hollywood, he kind of liked it in California. And he had a friend who was going to Cretona, which was the Theosophical Center in Hollywood. And he went to a couple of astrology, at least one astrology class that went on for a while. And he liked it. He thought it was interesting. It didn't really become his thing right away. He was exposed to it and that planted some seeds.
And this is like 1920?
1920, his first astrology class.
Okay. And so it was like something he thought was kind of vaguely interesting, but he wasn't really taken. He didn't really like sort of run away with it at that point, right?
Right. This didn't become his life thing right away. And he was interested in theosophy. But, you know, the Theosophical Society at that point was turning into something of a mess that often happens after the founder dies. Blavatsky died in 1891, I believe. So this was, you know, considerably after that. And of course, it was infighting, politics. He saw all of this and did not want to join the Theosophical Society. But he had a friend, an Indian theosophist, a very mysterious, interesting figure, B.J. Wadia, who's, he was an Indian theosophist and an amazing writer. And he kind of took Ridjar under his wing for a couple of years. And that's where Ridjar learned most of his theosophy. And for a couple of years, he made a daily practice of reading Blavatsky's works. So he was a freelance theosophist, I guess I would say, not an institutional theosophist.
Okay. And that's, you know, as opposed to somebody like Alan Leo, for example, and because that's one of the things that's weird that's often noted about the fact that you have these three astrologers in the early 20th century who are like the foundational figures for what became 20th century modern Western astrology, is that they were all three theosophists. That Alan Leo was a theosophist, Mark Edmund Jones was a theosophist, and so is Dane Rudyard. Although it's like Alan Leo was living in London in the UK when Madame Blavatsky was still alive and sort of there in the heart of it, whereas right. Rudyard is coming somewhat later after Blavatsky has died and the organization has fragmented a bit, and there was a bunch of different sort of teachers setting up, you know, their own approaches to theosophy and things like that. And he, I guess what you're saying is that he wasn't necessarily as drawn into, and he was a little bit put off by some of the institutional politics, but he was more interested in the sort of general theory underlying it. Because there's kind of a distinction that's sometimes brought up in historical discussions about this, which is that there is, you know, theosophy as it's defined with like a lowercase t, which is in theory just the idea that, I mean, how would you define that? There's many different philosophies around the world, but that they all have some sort of core underlying truth or connection between them.
Right. Yeah, Blavatsky didn't feel like she was really introducing something new. She said this was really a rebirth of the perennial philosophy. And, you know, she did a lot to bring together Western esotericism, Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, alchemy, all of those kind of things together with Buddhism, Hinduism, all of these new philosophies that were becoming available from the East. And her work was really, she was not an astrologer at all, but her work was full of allusions to the planets, to cycles, especially. It was a lot about cycles. So when Rudyard read this, I'm sure he was like, ah, I'm right there. Her whole thing was about cycles. So that must have been really exciting to him, to remind him of that insight he had. But, you know, it was a fertile territory for astrologers. So there was generations, really several generations of astrologers who were really influenced a lot by theosophy, even if they weren't organized theosophists. It was just such a stimulating set of teachings.
Right. I mean, and it, because it's tricky, because on the one hand, there's the underlying theory of theosophy with a lowercase t, which is that, you know, there's a sort of interchangeability, or that there's many different philosophical traditions that have come to similar insights and that they're not in conflict, but instead that they can kind of be merged together or seen as different variations of the same thing. And therefore, it provides a sort of pretense or an encouragement to study many different philosophical and religious traditions and to try to basically merge them or find where they can meet, versus the Theosophical Society as an organization with like a capital TS, which is essentially the doctrine and the organization that Madame Blavatsky founded in the late 19th century, which has theoretically at least that theosophy of the lowercase thing at its core. But then there's a lot of other things heaped on top of it, which have to do with, like, you know, her claims at having channeled basically divinely revealed wisdom from like ascended Tibetan masters and things like that. And so there's like a lot of other things that went into that. And then there's other people like that within the Theosophical Society, like Alice Bailey, who are also introducing new doctrines that are claiming to be, you know, channeled doctrines or things like that. And so Rudyard, being somebody who was already probably widely read up to that point, probably had a lot of interest in that general philosophy of, you know, seeing the truth or the validity in many different religious or philosophical approaches, but may have been more put off by some of the politics that came with the sort of institutional aspects of the Theosophical Society.
Oh, exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I believe I've read that people actually used the word theosopher way back in Hellenistic days with a small t. I'm not sure about that. Maybe you know, but they claim to not really come up with that term.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Just there's a lot of different claims that like the Theosophical Society and people involved in the early 20th century made, especially about what the ancient traditions said, that have sort of questionable legitimacy, or in some instances were actually true things, but they've used it for certain purposes. I mean, there's actually a really great book on this topic that they had us read at Kepler when we were studying early 20th century astrology, and we're focused on the Theosophical Society, and it's called Madame Blavatsky's Baboon is the title of the book. And I think the author is Peter Washington or something like that. It's a great, great overview of the history and origins of the Theosophical Society in the late 19th and early 20th century, as well as some of the later schools and sort of breakaway traditions that came out of the Theosophical Society. And it really focuses very much on that time period that Rudyard would have come in at the tail end of. And so you could get a lot better historical context for the sort of things that Rudyard was seeing, and that on the one hand, things that would have appealed to him, but on the other hand, the things that would have been off-putting to him at the same time during that time period in the like 1920s and 1930s.
Right, right. Absolutely. Theosophy, there's a fair amount of baggage involved, no doubt. But there was a lot of inspiration for, as I said, a couple of generations of astrologers. So,
sure. Yeah.
You know, Blavatsky herself is a very controversial figure. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, scandal and controversy. But on the other hand, you know, there was a lot of interesting things she brought to people's attention. So, you know, Rudyard took that ball and ran with it for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, one thing that we got on a sort of side discussion about last time, I think the other day, that I don't want to go too far down that track, but it's like I had a realization recently because I was talking to an astrologer about this other little like school of astrology that started in the past 20 or 30 years, where the founder claims to have like channeled or had some divine inspiration in order to come up with this new system of astrology in the past few decades. And that my initial inclination to that, because I tend to often be much more interested in the underlying philosophy and in the sort of empirical approach to astrology and other like things like that. And so I'm sometimes uncomfortable with those sort of attempts at putting this sort of mystic thing on astrology or just that sort of framing when somebody introduces a new approach or a new technique and claims that it was like divinely inspired. But one of the interesting realizations I had about that when I was reflecting on my own sort of reaction to that a few weeks ago was that there have been actually a few different points in the astrological tradition over the past few thousand years where you have had different astrologers who either claimed that or at least used that as a pretense in order to introduce a new system where, I mean, clearly in some instances, they're really just synthesizing previous approaches, but instead of taking credit for it, they're sort of attributing credit or they're attributing this system to coming from somebody else and just being revealed to them. And on some level, that's kind of what Blavatsky did, because she was claiming that she was getting messages from like ascended Tibetan masters and like stuff like that. And that's what she was supposedly writing down in her books, The Secret Doctrine and Isis Unveiled, which were like the foundational texts of the Theosophical Society. But on some level, it's like at different points, you have that in the astrological tradition to some extent as well. Like in the first century BCE, in the Hellenistic tradition with the founding of Hellenistic astrology, it was for some reason really popular in occult circles to not take credit for a work, but instead to put the name, to ascribe it when you published an astrological text to like a divine or a legendary or a mythical figure. And so that's why we have books like attributed to Hermes Trismegistus or Asclepius, or there were these other books that were really important that were attributed to an Egyptian pharaoh named Nechepso and a priest named Petasiris. And those actually became some of the most influential foundational texts of the astrological tradition, but they were, you know, attributed to other people, and those texts themselves may have claimed to have been divinely inspired or like revealed wisdom of some sort. So it's an interesting, like, recurring phenomenon where even if you're sort of uncomfortable with that, which I kind of am to, on some level, that to sort of recognize that that's a recurring phenomenon and perhaps something worth exploring. I mean, I think even some recent modern traditions, like some branches of evolutionary astrology, essentially claim some form of that, right?
Sure. And I guess, you know, we can just say that inspiration comes in a lot of different ways, I guess. Maybe that's the way to put it.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe we don't have to do a whole analysis and breakdown of that, but it's just an interesting.
Well, we may get to that by the end of this.
Sure. Okay. We'll see if we can circle around. So returning back to, sorry, after that long.
No, that was interesting.
Long digression. Totally right. So circling back to Rudyard. So he also had some sort of side jobs at this point, and there was a possibility that he could have ended up going like a different career track in the 1920s, right?
Yeah. Well, there he is. He's in Hollywood. Frenchman gets to Hollywood. And so he actually was acting in silent films for a while as an extra, as a stand-on. He did that for a while. And finally, he gave it up because it was, in his words, uncertain and boring. And he even was cast to play Christ in a play for 2 to 3 months. And if you've seen pictures of Rudyard, that's not hard to buy. You know, he could play Christ. That would work. He did house concerts just like he had done in New York. And he started doing house lectures on psychology, music, philosophy, art. You know, he wrote for a lot of different kinds of magazines at that point. He was writing articles for music magazines, metaphysical magazines, again, psychology articles. He had several different pen names. And this, so by the, you know, midway into the 20s, he already had this whole writing vocation going. And his primary activity in Hollywood, aside from writing and concerts and all this, was composing and performing music. And this was his period in his life of the most volume of compositions. But he brought writing and music together too. He wrote a couple of books on music during this period. And one of them was called The Rebirth of Hindu Music, which is given credit for being one of the first books on Indian music in English. He did that like in 1927, something like that. So he was pretty active in music and writing, and he seemed to like California. He seemed like he was going to stay. And in 1930, a friend of his, actually his first wife, gave him some copied notes from Mark Edmund Jones's astrology class. And 10 years before this, Rudyard had taken the class at the Theosophical Society and thought it was interesting. But when he read Mark Jones's writing, he was really excited. He said, ah, there's totally different possibilities for astrology. And I don't know what was in all these notes. I mean, I can kind of gather from reading things later on what was in here, but it really got him excited that astrology could be used in some other way than what he had learned.
So this is the point where he really caught the astrology bug, and astrology really started to become his primary focus in some sense.
He got really, really driven the way he would do. So yeah, he started really inhaling astrology at that point.
And I mean, Mark Edmund Jones is interesting because he really is a middle figure between, on the one hand, Alan Leo, and Alan Leo's really drawing on still, you know, the 17th century astrology, which is when some of the first astrology books are written in English. It's basically when the switch occurred, because prior to that point, astrology books in Europe were being written in Latin. And then all of a sudden you have William Lilly writing the first major textbook on astrology in English in like the, what, 1647 or something like that. And so, but that was right when astrology started dying out, basically. So you have like a few decades of books being written like that. And that's some of the stuff that Alan Leo would have been drawing on, but he also wanted to simplify the techniques of astrology and push it more towards character analysis. And then you have Mark Edmund Jones, who almost represents like a continuation of that, where you get a more character-driven astrology and a little bit more simplified technical astrology, like early 20th century astrology. But he also had this very sort of new age or theosophical bent, Mark Edmund Jones. And that's probably some of the stuff that, some of the insights and some of the spiritual or psychological or philosophical sort of focus and insights that Mark Edmund Jones had and would have shared in his private classes probably would have been the things that Rudyard got very excited about at that point in 1930.
I think you're right. Absolutely. So, you know, at that point he had his fuse lit, I guess.
Yeah. And one of the things that's interesting is actually when a decade ago, I actually came across photocopies of some of those Mark Edmund Jones classes and lectures. They're, really? They're like they're like written out on a typewriter. And these are like old photocopies of like classes. And he had a bunch of different classes on different types of astrology. But one of the things that really surprised me is one of the classes was on medieval astrology. And he actually had a relatively decent, sort of class, and it was on something like horary astrology or basically like the old traditional approach to horary and other types of astrology. So it was interesting and surprising to me to see that some of those early 20th century astrologers were drawing on or had access to some of that stuff, not necessarily all of it, but that it was part of the general, or at least there were pieces of it that were part of the general, you know, things that were going into the synthesis that turned into 20th century astrology.
Interesting. Huh. So Rudyard had never, was a student of Mark Edmund Jones, but they were friends really their whole lives after that, you know, next 50 years or how, I guess Jones lived till 1980, I believe.
So Jones lived similarly long as Rudyard.
Yeah. They were both pretty long lived. And, So they had continued contact throughout their life, but it's hard to say how much of Jones's astrology is in Rudyard's. It's kind of tough to say at this point.
Right. I mean, Mark Edmund Jones would be slightly, it looks like he was born October 1st, 1888, and Rudyard was born, what, March of 1895?
Right. So they weren't that far apart in age.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Edmund Jones would have been almost a decade older. So he's a little bit older than Rudyard, and he got his start in astrology a little bit sooner than Rudyard. So, you know, he would have initially probably around that time of 1930, at that point in Rudyard's studies, Jones would have been much more advanced than him and would have been thinking about the philosophy of astrology longer than Rudyard. So I could see how, you know, Rudyard would have come across that stuff and become very excited about his work initially, but then it probably wouldn't have taken that long for Rudyard to catch up. And that's right. Why they were probably more like contemporaries for most of their careers rather than like a teacher-student relationship.
Yeah, I think you're right. Exactly. And also, you know, Rudyard was still continuing with his music. And, you know, music was through his whole life. I think if you were to say what he would most want to be remembered for, it would probably be his music, which is surprising given his place in the astrological world. But he, you know, early on in his reading, I'm assuming when he was home as a teenager, he had read stuff about Pythagoras, you know, and all of his books about music, he's referencing Pythagoras quite a bit. And he could see all the obvious connections between music and astrology. They're all over the place, you know, trines and oppositions and cycle of fifths. And there's all these concepts in music that would relate to astrology quite strongly. And he had this idea of some people in the world being what he called seed people. You know, there's something about them that carries a message into a new age or to a new culture. And he thought that Pythagoras was one of these people. He bring in a lot of concepts like, you know, the foundational importance of numbers and reincarnation and all these other ideas that Pythagoras had. So, you know, he consciously referenced Pythagoras in his last book about music too, when he was, you know, in the 1980s. So this was, he was consciously thinking in those terms.
Right.
In 2009, there was a biography published, and it was a musical biography of Rudyard. And it's basically about his music. It covers him as an astrologer very little, actually. And I think that would have made him just really, really happy that the first biography was not even an astrological biography. It was a musical biography.
Sure. Well, not in the sense that he looks down on his astrological career or devalues it, but just that he was actually recognized as a composer by people almost a century later.
Yeah. And this woman wrote this biography saying he was a highly underappreciated modern composer, you know, and Ruggiero's music was interesting. I mean, he was not just a modernist, he was an ultra-modernist. And, you know, he was very avant-garde. And if anybody's familiar with this kind of music, he was interested. He played, his music was in the style of maybe Scriabin or Schoenberg or Varese. It's very challenging music. It wasn't background music by any means. You know, it would use the entire piano keyboard. You know, it had dissonance. It had, you know, challenging rhythms. It's, you know, it's challenging music. He could have done it the easy way and just played Chopin and Debussy and Saint-Saëns and all this great French classical music. But there was something in him that had to be on the edge, had to be avant-garde. And, you know, if anybody is interested in hearing some of his music, you know, without making a big deal about it, you could just get on YouTube, for instance, and there's a piece called Stars. So if you just type in Ruggiero and Stars, you'll come up with this fascinating piece. Or Kronos Quartet. This is a famous string quartet. And they, in the 1970s, Ruggiero was so happy about this. They did a whole string quartet version of some of his pieces. So those are available on YouTube, and it'll give you some idea what we're talking about here. But it was not meant to be widely popular music. It was, again, challenging, avant-garde, interesting, and very beautiful, actually, when you get used to it. But, you know, some people won't be used to it.
Sure.
You know, as his astrology ramped up over the years, he did less music, for sure. And, you know, because he was getting all this recognition for astrology, and he wasn't getting as much recognition for music, especially during the Depression and during the 30s. It was a tough time in music. You know, people didn't, a lot of the house concert stuff dried up. So he was doing less of that. And in fact, he moved to Santa Fe in the 40s, and he took up painting and didn't play music for quite a while and became a pretty proficient painter.
Yeah, actually. So, and some of his paintings are still around, and they're actually pretty good and interesting. It's actually kind of impressive.
Yeah. They're very, as he would call them, archetypal.
Right. So one of his things was often he tried to actually paint or show in painted form, like archetypes, like an archetype of something, mm-hmm. Right?
Right. To get as he would say, a glimpse into the realm of forms, you know, that Plato would have mentioned.
Right. And that's so interesting because, you know, he's a musician, he's an astrologer, he's a painter, he's a philosopher. I mean, he really was like a polymath of some sort, in that he was very, very widely read in a number of different fields, and he also tended to excel in most of those fields that he really engaged himself in. And that's really interesting because it sort of also ties into what you were talking about earlier in terms of his interest in the Pythagorean connections between music and astrology, and how that's something he would often come back to, because that's also, it's unique in terms of his role in the 20th century, but it's actually something that reminds me of another very famous and prominent astrologer and a lot of these things surrounding Ruggiero, which is Claudius Ptolemy from the second century, who was like Ruggiero in that he was also a polymath who, you know, focused on a number of different fields and wrote very influential and important works where he excelled in each of those fields. But one of them was in the field of harmonics or music theory, and another was in astrology. And he tried to show the connection between music theory and astrology. So there's an interesting sort of connection there in terms of, you know, having a singular astrologer that has a huge influence on the later tradition, and who is like a polymath who excels in and sees the connection between a bunch of different scientific or philosophical or other types of fields of knowledge.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, within a couple of months of painting, people were saying, you've got to be selling these paintings. You know, he had exhibitions within a couple of months of taking a painting.
Okay. And some of those ended up on like later book covers, right?
Right. Yeah, there are pictures of most of them that you can find on the internet very easily. You know, a lot of them were sold and the originals disappeared. We don't really know where they are. And there's a lot of stuff that's not really released. I mean, it's kind of hidden away somewhere. But so, yeah, painting was, you know, he didn't do that for that long. I mean, he had a very heavy astrological workload that we'll talk about. But there were a couple of times in his main period of composing and musical activity was in the 1920s and the early 30s, and then music took off. And later on, in the early 1950s, there was a period of interest where people said, you know, you've got to come to New York. And there was a few years of a lot of Rudyard concerts, things like that. And then that kind of died away. And then later on in his career, in the late 60s, early 70s, his music kind of blossomed. They had lots of performances. And we'll talk about that later. But he had a whole other musical life came up later once he was well known as an astrologer. So we have his first book was written on music, Debussy. His second book was on Hindu music. And then he didn't do a music book for a long time. And his very last book that he wrote was a book called The Magic of Tone and the Art of Music. And he talks a lot about Pythagorean theory and musical theory. It's a fascinating book. He was really driven to finish this one before he passed. This was what he really wanted to finish.
And what year did he publish that in?
It was 1982.
Okay.
So he was late 80s, which is pretty impressive. He actually at one point called, and I heard this in one of his talks, he called astrology applied numerology. He thought there was so much number and Pythagoreanism in astrology and music, applied numerology.
Right. And then that is extended also to music and the different chords and like progressions and things like that.
Exactly. So that, you know, those kind of ideas lasted his whole life. But as he went on, you know, theosophy became less of his main influence because he kept reading, you know. So, you know, in his ideas, as he's starting to take off at astrology, you know, you have the Alan Leo, Sepharel, Max Heindel, the Rosicrucians, Mark Edmund Jones, and some of the earlier astrological authors that he read, like Ptolemy and Gadbury. These all kind of came together in his astrology. And of course, Blavatsky, but someone gave him in 1932 the complete works of Jung, collected works of Jung.
Carl
Jung, yeah. He apparently took a few months and read the whole thing.
Wow. Okay, so that's like very early. It's like Jung is still alive and active. And
right.
Suddenly right. You have this astrologer receiving a bunch of his works and then just devouring them.
That's what he would do. Apparently from some of the books that was not a fast read, but he did. And he had already read Freud and he had already read Bergson, who wrote The Creative Evolution, which really was a book that really sparked him, and Platonism. All this kind of came together in what he was doing. But then at that time, there was a lot of interest in the new sciences. You know, Einstein was, you know, pretty well known at that point, the ideas of relativity. And of course, Schoenberg and a lot of the people working on quantum mechanics. Rudyard read extensively on this stuff. He was always quite up to date on what was going on in these sciences and holism and the emerging complexity theories. And so the new sciences, psychology, the astrology was all kind of coming together for him.
Sure.
During this period.
And his later works then reflected that, where he tried to synthesize sort of insights from all of those different fields together into a sort of new synthesis. And that, you know, again, that really echoes things that have happened in different eras in astrology, where you do have the creation of a new approach to astrology that reflects, you know, both integrating and synthesizing the previous traditions, but also often, you know, taking into account the current scientific understanding and what are the new or the prevailing scientific theories about the nature of the cosmos and how the world works and everything else that often gets integrated into whatever the astrology is at the time. And so again, that takes us back to somebody like Ptolemy, who, you know, in the mid second century, when he wrote the Tetrabiblos, he was taking what were the contemporary prevailing, like new scientific ideas and theories about how the cosmos worked. And he was trying to integrate them and synthesize them with astrology in order to explain how astrology made sense from the contemporary scientific and intellectual perspective, and to almost place astrology on a more solid footing by giving it that scientific as well as philosophical and sort of metaphysical or empirical footing. So it's interesting seeing Rudyard doing the same thing. But anyways, the point of that is just that oftentimes astrology, as it's practiced in any era, partially ends up being a reflection of the way that contemporary people saw the world and how the world was thought to work during those time periods.
Yeah, it's absolutely interesting. Fascinating.
All right. So Rudyard, during this time, so we're still essentially talking about the 1920s and 30s, and he, as we said, was a prolific author, right?
He seemed to be writing his entire life. And all through the 1920s, as I said, he wrote for a lot of different kinds of magazines, art, music, psychology articles, philosophy articles, all through the 1920s. But once he started reading the Mark Edmund Jones material, he wrote a bunch of pamphlets that he called Harmonic Astrology. And this was really fascinating stuff. And it had to do with music theory and chords, and he equated it to the sun, moon, and ascendant being a chord, and all this interesting stuff, vibration, and a lot of interesting ideas. And Alice Bailey had found some of these pamphlets and really, really liked them. And she introduced him to a gentleman named Paul Clancy, who was an astrological publisher. And he was just starting a magazine called American Astrologer that's been actually a very long-lived magazine.
American Astrology?
Right. And so Paul Clancy in 1932 told Rudyard that I will publish whatever you write. He was so impressed with his books, his pamphlets, Harmonic Astrology. So Rudyard got to work, and he wrote a whole bunch of articles for American Astrology. And as I said, he had just finished the entire collected works of Jung, and he started working on the Astrology of Personality, which is to this day his best known work. And that was published in 1936.
So this is his first major book on astrology, is the Astrology of Personality?
Right. And it was probably his seventh book overall. He had written several music books, but this is his first astrology book.
Okay. And this was, you know, a landmark, or at least in retrospect, you know, many decades later, not quite a century later, but at least like 3/4 of a century later, this is a landmark publication. I'm not sure how popular it was initially when it was first released, but certainly in subsequent decades, it came to be recognized as a very important and influential text, basically, right?
Yes. And it was by no means a beginner's book. It was clearly intermediate or advanced, you know, and it was popular in terms of being a serious astrology book, but in terms of, you know, major numbers, I don't know how much it sold at first, but it certainly made a reputation as a serious astrologer.
Right. So it's like a thinking person's astrology book, and he doesn't pull any punches intellectually. It's like, these are high level discussions of like the philosophy and conceptualization of astrology, in addition to the techniques and trying to get to the first principles underlying how astrology works and why, and, you know, why there are certain significations for certain things. He really wanted to unravel and explain where those come from and what the conceptualization or rationales are.
Right. It was very ambitious. And some, you know, in many ways a difficult book, because he crammed so much in there. And, you know, he had articles that he had written. So it was a kind of a combination of articles and new material, as things often are. And, you know, it's been continually in publication. It's one of his few books that have always been in publication. And, you know, he was very surprised, he said, over the years, how many people in different parts of the world knew about the book. Because, you know, America at that time wasn't necessarily the best way to gauge that. So he was always pretty surprised that it had gotten around the world and people had read it.
Sure. And I mean, one of the things about Rudyard, especially his early writings, is that he was very wordy, and he used like a lot of words. So this is like a 500-page book, and it's very dense, and some of like his sentences are very like, so kind of complicated in some sense. And that was almost like a writing style that he was using very early on. I mean, I don't know if to what extent this is true. It's probably only partially true if that, but somebody, a bookseller once at a bookstore in Seattle told me like 10 years ago that some of Rudyard's like early writings may have been denser because he's being paid by the word. And so there may be some areas where that was like kind of relevant. I doubt that that's the only thing motivating that. And instead it's just, he's trying to explain very complicated topics and he's a very deep thinker. So naturally, you know, his writing is going to be a little bit hard to penetrate, and you would see his writing eventually grow and evolve over the years. So even though Astrology of Personality is probably one of his more difficult books to read, his books get a little bit easier. There was a sort of progression in his writing style in terms of astrology books, right?
Yes, absolutely. And you have to remember too that English was a second language. So it's, you know, it's not that easy always to write in your second language. And he was expressing difficult thoughts, complicated thoughts. But, you know, a lot of times people start reading Rudyard, they start with Astrology of Personality because it was so, you know, such a huge book in terms of the history of astrology, but it's difficult. And a lot of people don't get past that. And it's kind of a shame actually, because he has some other stuff that's just so much easier to read. I mean, he wrote a book a few years after that called The Pulse of Life that's all about the zodiac. And it's just beautiful. It's poetic. It's so easy to read. It's probably, to my mind, the best book I've ever read about the zodiac. And it's out of print at this point, but it's available for free on Chaldea.com. And we'll talk about that later. But it's, I would say that kind of thing is more the place to start reading Rudyard. He has a number of other books that are much easier. So even though this has been continually in print and is really a magnum opus in a lot of ways, there's much easier, more clear things to read. I think the business about being paid per word was more related to magazine articles.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But then they would try to keep the articles short because they didn't want to have 20 page articles. They wanted 4, 5, 6 pages. So I think he just wrote more articles to get that penny a word.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, the Astrology of Personality is important though, because even though it's a very difficult book, really Rudyard lays the foundations of modern psychological astrology essentially in this book. And most of the later things that became commonplace in later authors, you know, who became popular in the psychological astrology movement and the humanistic and transpersonal astrology movements in the 1980s and 90s and more recently, like you can trace a lot of that back to this book. And you can see that Rudyard was talking about some of that stuff decades and decades before anyone else. So he's got to be one of the first astrologers to truly read and understand Carl Jung's work and attempt to integrate the depth psychology and some of the insights from Carl Jung's approach to depth psychology into his astrology, starting with this book in 1936, essentially, right?
Right, absolutely. And he had apparently really, really internalized Jung's work.
Right. And so you've got that. You've got, you know, he's laying the foundation with the cyclical phenomena, the approach to viewing astrology as the study of cycles and recontextualizing, you know, the zodiac and the houses and the doctrine of aspects as being different types of cycles, but that archetypally they're all fundamentally the same thing and can be reduced to those concepts essentially. I think that's already in the first book, right?
Right. Yes. And, you know, he did a lot of writing in that period. So we have the Astrology of Personality, but that kind of kicked off 45 years of writing articles.
Yeah. And before we move on just a sec, because I want to make sure we get enough coverage of the Astrology of Personality, just because it's such a pivotal work in his career. So one of the other things, there's two other things before we move on. One of them is that he says very clearly at one point in this book that astrology is not the study of celestial influences on earthly events necessarily, but it primarily has to do with correlations between celestial phenomenon and earthly events. So he actually explicitly attempts to, in the Astrology of Personality, conceptualize astrology as dealing with basically like a phenomenon that has to do with like synchronicity or something like that, or being an acausal phenomenon, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Astrology as signs, I think you would call it.
Right. An astrology of signs rather than an astrology of causes. And I've got my copy in front of me because I just, because I highlighted this from whenever I read this like 10 years ago, because I thought it was so fascinating that Rudyard was already talking about this in the 1930s. But he, let me see. So here's one of the paragraphs. I'm not sure if this is the right one that I have highlighted. He says, on page 41, the proposition or belief rather that planets or stars actually influence individual human beings by the fact of sending their Earth-like radio or radio-like waves or rays to Earth, which affect biological and psychological processes. Now, even if these rays were discovered, and even if it became clear that they act upon atoms and molecules of Earth substance in definite and measurable ways, this would in no way prove the usual findings of astrology. A restricted kind of natal astrology might be evolved, which might claim, after centuries of research, the status of an experimental science, but this would only solve a fragment of the problems involved in the sum total of astrological ideas. So it's like right there he's saying, while at some point we might discover scientifically that the planets and the stars do have some effect on life on Earth in the same way that, let's say, like, you know, the sun affects and you know, allows for plants to grow through photosynthesis, or the moon has an effect on the tides and stuff like that. While we might discover some sort of astrological influence at some point, that's not even, if we do, going to fully account for all of the different things that astrologers claim to be able to do with astrology. But instead, you have to understand astrology as a symbolic sort of approach to interpreting events through some sort of a causal phenomenon. Yeah, and he returns to that, but I was always really struck by that, because I often assume that became the dominant, you know, paradigm, especially in psychological astrology in the late 20th century from the 1970s onward. But I assumed that that was like a later development that happened with the psychological astrologers in the 1960s and 70s, once Jung had become fully integrated into the astrological tradition, or at least appropriated by psychological astrologers. But in fact, Rudyard was already making these statements in the 1930s and sort of emphatically saying that astrology was not necessarily the study of celestial influences.
Right. No, well put.
And that's a really, you know, something that he stuck with. And that was a concept or a sort of philosophical point that he came back to throughout his works, right?
Right. Right.
Okay. And the other thing before we move on, I just wanted to touch on about the astrology of personality, is there's things like that where you can trace back certain philosophical concepts or certain philosophical techniques to this book. And so one of the techniques that I actually traced back to it, or one of the conceptualizations, was with the North and South Node, where at one point about 10 years ago, I was trying to research, because I noticed there was this weird distinction between the way that the nodes, the North Node of the Moon and the South Node of the Moon, are viewed and interpreted by astrologers in the West in the late 20th and early 21st century, where they're usually associated with like one's past life and one's future life. And what I noticed when I started reading texts from Hellenistic and medieval astrology is that it was weird that they never talked about that, that conceptualization didn't exist in the pre-20th century Western tradition. So then the question I had is, I tried to research, where did it come from and at what point did it enter into the astrological tradition? And so I tried to trace it backwards, starting from the present in the early 21st century. And I actually got as far back as this book, as Dane Rudyard and the Astrology of Personality, where he has this brief discussion about the North and South Node, which is almost like a philosophical exploration, where he's trying to look at like the astronomy of the North Node and South Node, and he's trying to tease out the meanings and only almost like speculate what they might mean by starting with sort of basic philosophical principles and then trying to go from there. And he almost sort of suggests in this segment that they might have something to do with like where the native is going versus where they're coming from. And there's almost like this sort of throwaway speculative line about maybe they have something to do with one's future versus one's past life or something like that. But he doesn't really explore it very much from there. And I'm pretty sure that you might actually be able to trace a large part of where modern astrologers have gone with the nodes and the sort of interpretive framework for using them back to this book. And I know that that's something that we sort of talked about should probably be a separate episode at some point, all about the nodes and their history and where different influences and things come from. But there's little things like that that are another reason that this is a important but sometimes overlooked or underappreciated book in some instances.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, basically all of the people that came up with evolutionary astrology had read Rudyard pretty thoroughly. Stephen Forrest, Jeff Green, they both were very well steeped in Rudyard's teachings. And I agree that the first really big, really thought out presentation about the nodes, because that was a pretty substantial chapter in the Astrology of Personality. It's called Planetary Interweavings. And he also talked about the part of fortune in that same chapter, very interestingly.
I actually highlighted a few lines that might be worth reading here from the node section. He says, at one end of this line, we see the past, the south node, at the other, the future, what the personality emerged from, what it is meant to accomplish. And then a few paragraphs later, another highlighted sentence I have, he says, by negative accomplishments, I mean those which really belong to the soul's past and which are either a repetition of things so learnt that they have become almost automatic, or the breaking down of psycho-mental crystallizations. And then later he says, at the end of this, he says, the nodal axes or lines of nodes give us the directional forces of destiny. So it's like looking, you know, listening to that in retrospect from our perspective in the astrological tradition now, it's like all of that's sort of commonplace things. And we would immediately jump to, you know, that he's talking about the future versus the past life, but it's a much more subtle discussion he's not like immediately jumping to statements about this is your future life and this tells you your past life. It's like he's just having this sort of philosophical exploration, trying to tease out the concepts. But what he ended up doing there was setting the foundation that a lot of later astrologers drew on and then sort of expanded and sort of ran with in order to create much more elaborate or sort of concrete interpretive principles surrounding the nodes.
Right. That was very, very influential chapter. And he wrote about the nodes in a number of books, actually. But that was really a very clear statement and I think has had a lot of influence. And you know, there's a lot of material there. But exactly the quote you just said is pretty much dead center evolutionary astrology, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it becomes the center. And it's like, for them, that becomes then tied into the broader sort of belief in reincarnation and the north node, therefore signifying where you're going, and the south node indicating things in previous lives. But for Rudyard, at least in that book, he was a lot more circumspect or sort of reserved about stating that explicitly, or even, I don't know that he was even necessarily endorsing that was definitely the case in like a literal sense, but he was talking much more generally. So it's interesting to see him essentially introducing the idea, but talking much more generally and sort of philosophically about it, and then how that became a much more concrete interpretive principle for later astrologers, you know, decades later, who sort of were influenced by Rudyard's work and then elaborated upon it.
Right. Well, actually, he kept that basic stance really through all his work. That, you know, he would oftentimes say past lives, and he would put air quotes on it, which he did in that book, in Astrology of Personality, meaning, and he would sometimes say, look, we don't, you know, we may not fully understand how reincarnation works. And he was a very careful person. He didn't want to overstate things. So, you know, he thought it had to do with the past, but he wasn't necessarily so willing to, you know, to turn it into a formal doctrine.
Sure. And then that later, I mean, because what's interesting, I remember asking Stephen Forrest about this a decade ago, and it was a really brief conversation. But on the one hand, he was influenced by Rudyard and read Rudyard's works. But, I asked him, you know, because I was trying to research this nodes thing, and I was like, where did you get that idea from, that it had to do with the north node is the future and the south node is the past life? And he said, that he was reading like Martin Shulman's book on the nodes, which was published in like the 1960s or 70s, and that it was already almost like a contemporary idea by the time that he got into the astrological community. And then he just took it to the next step or took it further by then following that line of thought to its full conclusion. But it's interesting to whatever extent, and we'll have to explore this in a separate episode where we actually review the full history and of the conceptualization of the nodes. But it's interesting thinking about that as a more recent phenomenon and thinking about its origins and how that developed as a concept.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating topic for sure. And, you know, this is just another place where Rudyard had a huge influence.
Yeah.
And it goes right to today.
But it's interesting because that influence now, because we're talking about a book published in the 1936 that then influenced a generation of astrologers that came in the 1960s and 70s. And then that generation of astrologers itself has influenced other subsequent generations of astrologers that have written their own books or are at least starting to, so that it's like you're getting Rudyard still in some of the books you're reading today, but it's being filtered through other astrologers. You don't necessarily know that you're getting Rudyard.
Right. No, I've had that same discussion with people, and they're quite surprised to hear, you know, what he was saying in 1936. I mean, not just about this issue, about other things too, but this issue was one that's pretty obvious. You know, he was pretty far in front of the pack, in essence.
Yeah. I mean, I had a friend, a prominent modern astrologer who, you know, he didn't know. And I had to tell him like a few years ago that a lot of these ideas that you're using can actually be traced back to Rudyard. And you should really read like that discussion about the nodes, because everything you're saying about the nodes can be traced back to that discussion in this book from 1936, because he was getting it filtered through his teachers over the past few decades. And now he's, you know, very enthusiastic about Rudyard and Rudyard's work and life and everything else. All right. So
thank you for that.
Right. So thanks for lingering on the astrology of personality with me. So now we can move on. So this begins like a very prolific sort of period in his life in terms of astrological writing, right?
Sure. So he had written his first book, and it was a blockbuster in astrological terms, I guess you could say.
I mean, was it a blockbuster? I mean, because that's one
of
the things.
Well, certainly it was, you know, serious astrologers certainly knew about it. You know, it wasn't, again, astrology books even now are not blockbuster. I was saying that tongue in cheek, really.
Right. Well, relative to, I mean, because one of the questions is Rudyard didn't really receive a lot of recognition for his astrological texts for the first few decades until that generation that came in the 1960s and 70s, right?
Right. So he was continuing to write books. And as I said, Paul Clancy said, "I will publish whatever you write." And so that's what happened. Rudyard started writing, and he wrote probably close to 1,100 or 1,200 articles over the next 45 years. And that's quite a pace, as you can imagine. And between that and all his books that were coming out at the same time. So he was pretty busy. As I said, a lot of it was going into articles and magazines. I was very surprised how many astrological magazines were around in those days. And there was a lot. There was probably 8 or 9 that he wrote for. And he would oftentimes write under pseudonyms also because he was writing a lot. And I'm sure he was getting his penny a word. So that was adding up.
Sure.
So, you know, as we discussed, it's got to be one of the highest totals ever.
Yeah, in terms of overall astrology books.
Right. But, you know, during this... Yeah, okay.
Sorry, it was 44 to 50-ish books, we're thinking?
Yeah. Well, I went back and did a recount the other day, and I would put it much closer to 50, and then there were pamphlets beyond that. So I finally decided I should figure out how many were astrology and how many were philosophy. And some of them, it's hard to tell. They're half astrology, half philosophy.
Right. And then there's other books, of course, on music and poetry and other things.
Right. He even wrote 2 novels.
Okay.
Which I have not read. Maybe I'll read them someday.
And it's really funny because in his birth chart, so his birth data you can find on astro.com for anyone who's interested. And I don't remember, is this a recorded time or is this rectified?
He rectified it by about 12 minutes, I believe, at one point.
Okay, so the given time it looks like is between midnight and 1 a.m. And he rectified it to 12:42 a.m., which is basically that right in the middle, right. But it looks like pretty much regardless if it was between midnight and 1 a.m., it was Sagittarius rising. So he was born March 23rd, 1895 at, according to his rectified time, 12:42 a.m. in Paris, France. And that gives his ascendant as 13 degrees of Sagittarius rising. And I was looking at his chart the other day, trying to understand why was he such a prolific writer. And it's really funny. He has Sagittarius rising, and the ruler of the ascendant is Jupiter, which is placed in Gemini in the seventh house, along with a stellium of other planets, with Neptune, Mars, and Pluto also in Gemini. And Jupiter is in Gemini, ruled by Mercury, and Mercury is at 4 degrees of Pisces. So at least traditionally, it's kind of interesting because there's a mutual reception between Mercury and Jupiter being in each other's domiciles. And then he has, I'm not sure if it's there from a quadrant perspective, but at least in whole sign houses, he has the moon in the third house in Aquarius. Is that where it is quadrant-wise as well?
I don't have his chart right in front of me.
Okay, no problem. Let me see if I can pull it up. But yeah, so like a super, you know, Gemini placements, super amped up kind of Mercury is what we got there. And you end up with somebody who, you know, wrote over 1,000 articles and like 50 books or something like that.
Yeah. It's quite a total.
So he's probably, you know, we're guessing, I mean, if anyone knows any better, please correct us, but we're guessing that this is probably, he's easily one of, but he may actually be the most prolific astrological writer in history potentially, right?
I guess we'll see what other candidates we get, but I sure can't think of any.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to correct us, please do. But otherwise, we will sort of proceed just because I can't really think of anyone else who's written more actual astrology books and articles than him. I mean, with articles, it's a little bit hard to track. And I know there's other astrologers who write a ton of articles, but that's still a lot even relative to that.
Right. We'll see what people suggest.
Sure. Okay. So, and so he had some of those other influences that we talked about earlier in the early 20th century, but then later he didn't just like stop reading or taking in other influences, but he also had other influences on his work as well, right?
It was amazing. He seemed to also have a lot of time for reading because he, you know, he moved beyond theosophy and beyond just Blavatsky. And he became friends with Roberto Assagioli, who was the founder of psychosynthesis. They became really lifelong friends. It was really a very spiritualized psychology that actually moved quite a bit beyond Jung. Very interesting material. And he became fascinated with the Indian philosopher Sri Aurobindo, who was an amazing figure. And Aurobindo ended up being the inspiration for the California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS. And Rudyard was heavily involved with his teachings in the 1940s, 1950s, long before there was CIIS. Teilhard de Chardin and even Rupert Sheldrake, amazingly enough, in his last book in the 1980s, he's still reading. He's still picking up new things. And, you know, all of this continued. You could see all these influences in his later work, you know, that moved quite a bit beyond theosophy. As I said, Sri Aurobindo was very big for him and actually a lot of other people.
Okay. And so in terms of our notes, I mean, at this point, it might be good to give just the last part of his, just the history of his life, basically, in terms of where his later career went after the 1940s, and then bring it to a close with the 1980s. And then we can talk about, with the rest of our time, just some of his key philosophies and thoughts.
Okay.
So what was, give me the short version of the history of like Rudyard's life from the 1950s through the 1980s.
So in the 1940s, he moved to New Mexico and World War II was in full swing. And he was writing like crazy, still writing a lot of articles, writing books. And the articles were getting published. Some of the books were getting published, but toward the end of the 1940s, you know, and the beginning of the 1950s, he moved to New York to, because people had come to him in New Mexico and said, Rudyard, your music is getting popular again. Young musicians are interested in playing your pieces. And he's happily living in New Mexico, and he decides to pick up with his wife and move to New York. So he stayed there for 4 years back in New York and And there was apparently a lot of activity around his music, at least for a while, a flurry for a couple of years. And then, you know, as often happens with avant-garde music, you know, it kind of, the interest died down for a while. So he ended up moving away from New York because it's a lot of problems with living in New York. And he moved to the Midwest somewhere and continued to write articles. But it was getting more and more difficult to get astrology books published in the 1950s. It was a very conservative time.
Sure.
So, you know, towards the end of the 50s, he had a pile of books laying around. He had a lot of writing he'd been doing. So he decided, I have to do something different instead of just staying here. So he went back to Europe a couple of times in 1960, 61, 62. And he was really quite surprised at the interest that he got. It's almost like American jazz musicians going to Europe in those days. You know, they were getting far more recognition in Europe than they were getting here. And that was the case for Rudyard. He was, you know, he was treated like a king in England, you know, at the various astrological societies. They were super happy to have him. He was speaking all over Europe. He went to France and Italy and was being treated like a celebrity, which was not happening in the U.S. And if I was him, I think I would have been thinking about, why don't I just stay?
Right.
Because things were looking pretty good. But he found a publisher in Holland who was very enthusiastic and had funds and started publishing Rudyard's work. So Rudyard got piles and piles of books. And I guess he decided to stay in the New World, according to his original inspiration, I guess. So he decided to come back to the New World. And this was, you know, 63, 64. With lots of books all of a sudden. And he was living in Southern California. And around 1965, a lot of interesting things started happening. All of a sudden, he started having young people get interested in his works. People started seeking him out because at that point, astrology was, much more for older people. It wasn't something young people were really interested in. But this is the beginning of the 1960s, 65 or so. And funny that Rudyard had a loosing of the bonds in 1965, along with some other interesting astrological stuff going on in his chart.
Right.
But he went from
zodiac releasing, which always indicates like a major transition and like shake up in the terms of the person's career and life direction. So that hits right in the middle of the 1960s.
Right in the middle of 1965. Yes.
Perfect.
And he started all of a sudden getting all kinds of young people seeking out his teachings. His bookings for speaking started going crazy. He started going around doing speaking tours. And now he had books to sell and books for people to read.
Right. So there's this sudden influx of like energy and youth and enthusiasm into the astrological community through the counterculture movement and through the hippies and everything else that explodes from the mid-1960s onward.
Right. And I've joked with some friends, you know, people needed to take a lot of LSD to be able to understand what his thinking was like.
Right. Or to get through some of his books. But so you get like young, passionate and intelligent, like people coming into the astrological community. And suddenly, you know, it must have been really wild to find this guy, this figure who's like older now, but who's been writing really deep, thoughtful works on astrology for a few decades up to that point. And he hadn't really in the US been widely recognized or sort of hailed for that work. But there was something about his approach to talking about astrology in a psychological and a philosophical sense and trying to merge it with depth psychology that really meshed well with the sort of zeitgeist of the time and a lot of the astrologers who came in at that point in the 1960s and 70s. And they embraced him and his work sort of took off and like jumped to this whole new level at that point.
Right. And it's interesting. There was this, you know, very distinguished Frenchman who always wore a suit, always had a nice haircut, had a lovely French accent and, you know, and the counterculture, it seemed a little unlikely, but they were reading what he was writing and what he had to say. And it was of a lot of interest. And it's interesting because during that whole period, 1965 and 1967, the Uranus-Pluto conjunction was happening right on the south node of his moon.
Wow.
Near the top of his chart. He had this loosing of the bond and his you know, his career really took off like a rocket at that point. He was all of a sudden quite in demand.
Right. So there's a bunch of different techniques indicating it. And that really was the pivotal turning point in terms of his overall career and his legacy in retrospect. And, you know, probably helped that he was like living in Southern California at like the epicenter of a lot of that, you know, in the 1960s.
Right. So he was traveling a lot he lived in San Jacinto, California, and he was traveling to LA, traveling up to the Bay Area. You know, so he wasn't really right in the middle of the action. He was living in a very quiet corner of Southern California, but still, he was pretty close to the action.
And, sure.
You know, a lot of things were going on for him. He was starting to give talks at Esalen, for instance. And Richard Tarnas talked about these talks that he gave as being really pivotal in his thinking. And he gave talks at the California Institute of Asian Studies, which was, you know, later turned into CIIS, gave a lot of talks there. And, you know, he was getting very well known. And about 1969, 1967, his music started getting well known again too, which again must have made him very, very happy, because on the internet, KPFA has got a whole bunch of recordings from early 1970s of Rudyard being interviewed about his music. And there were all these music festivals around the country playing his music.
Wow.
And it was in honor of him, just as the figure he was too. But, you know, his music was all of a sudden popular again. It hadn't been that popular since, you know, the early 50s, when he had a streak of popularity going. So it all seemed to be kind of rolling his way there. It was quite a revival. And in 1974, he got married to Leila Real. And, you know, so in 1974, he was 79 years old, and he was probably near the peak of his fame and influence. And it's ironic that he had his success so late in life, or his outward success. And this was hugely lucky for him, because he had a lot of works in progress. He had a lot of scores. He had a lot of manuscripts to finish. And, you know, and it was getting harder, as it does. So, you know, his wife Leila was just a huge help in getting these things finished, getting them published. A lot of his really important works were in that last 10 years. You know, his major philosophical works, major orchestral works. A lot of this happened then, and there's no way he could have pulled it off, you know, without this care and support.
Right, during that last 10 years of his life. So they were married in 1974, and then he died in 1985, but that he had a huge number of his works were published in that decade.
Right. So, you know, I think I personally really like to thank Leila for that, because we would be missing a large chunk of his work. I don't think that many people could have supported that. So, and I don't think she practices, and she was quite an impressive astrologer in her own right, and co-wrote a book with him and added a section later to the lunation cycle. And she's still living in Northern California, remarried. But the astrological world has got to thank her for that.
Yeah, she would be a great person to interview at some point, just in terms of her. She must have a very unique perspective about that, and seeing, you know, the community embracing him and that huge output of work in the last years of his life.
Yeah, that would be a fascinating interview for sure. That'd be great.
All right. So that brings us to the end of his story. So he passed away in 1985. So it's actually been 32 years since he passed away at the age of 90, right?
Right. Right. And, you know, you could still, as you were saying, his influence is very strong. You know, even if people don't know about it, his influence is quite strong. And evolutionary astrology, psychological astrology, even archetypal astrology. You know, this Richard Tarnas is quite influenced by Rudyard. And, you know, it's nice that so much of that influence is there, and Rudyard would have a serene smile on his face about it, I'm sure. You know, but as I said, a lot of people just don't know his name anymore. And so this is a really nice thing that that we can at least talk about this. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important to just recognize the contributions that different astrologers have made in history and help to contextualize, you know, because you might come across a book in a bookstore, like a used bookstore or online, where you see a book by like Dane Rudyard, and you don't really know who that is. You just know he's some astrologer who, you know, lived several decades ago or flourished a century ago almost. And understanding why his work is important and why you might want to read it is, you know, part of what we're doing here and what I'm always doing when I do these sorts of biographical episodes.
Right. It's great. It's fantastic. And, you know, there's still actually a lot of techniques and kind of undiscovered gems in his work, because he wrote so many articles over so much time. He was always looking for new techniques. I mean, he was, you know, not cut off from the new. He was always looking, as you can imagine, having to fill that much space, right?
Right. Yeah. And why don't we actually go, so let's back up and actually go through some of that with our last, let's say 20 or 30 minutes here before we cut it off at 2 hours, which is a decent sized, you know, podcast discussion. So one of the things we were going to talk about was, you know, some of his views about what is astrology for. So do you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. And, you know, this is one place where he really does have a lot of influence. And Rudyard, when he talked about astrology, said astrology is really a discipline of mind. It's a way to develop a more holistic view, to see things in bigger chunks. And he called it developing the mind of wholeness, you know, because usually our minds are analytical and quite divided. But to really understand astrology, you can't just be looking at individual planets, individual factors. You have to step back. And he would talk about developing this ability to what he called clear thinking, or feel thinking, the ability to feel the wholeness of a person and the wholeness of a chart that's beyond the small parts. So he really advocated, basically, astrology is kind of a spiritual discipline of being able to develop this mind of wholeness.
So like a holistic, let's say, approach to astrology?
Yes. And at one point he said that he was the first person to popularize the word holistic, which I have no reason to doubt that. I believe he did.
Sure, I could see that. And so part of that philosophy then, or the distinction, is the difference between, you know, really focusing in on, you know, what does Venus in my fifth house, you know, mean in this sign, versus looking at it from a broader perspective of the chart and the life as a whole, and a sort of broad trajectory, or maybe that's not a good way to, maybe a better way would be like, what does this specific event or transit that's happening right now mean right now immediately for me, versus he would focus more on the big picture of, you know, how does this fit into the larger overall arc of your life as a whole?
Exactly. And, you know, he had a goal. The goal was basically that astrology would make it easier to live, you know, make life more satisfying and enable us to deal with adversity when it comes, you know. And the Stoics had a similar idea to what the Stoics had. They thought that by trying to predict events, that things were fated, that you could get ready for things, that you could basically become more resilient. You know, you wouldn't be as surprised and knocked off balance by life. You know, you could just accept life as it is. And Rudyard had that similar kind of goal, but he said, instead of trying to predict things, you know, we need to see crises, difficulties, Pluto transits, Saturn transits as part of a cycle, you know, that things come and go, things change, you know, and very often with it, you know, without astrology, we think that whatever life is like right now, we project it forward. It will always be like this. And of course, the great gift of astrology is knowing that it's not always going to be like this. Things are going to change. There's a cycle.
Right. And viewing change and not necessarily attributing a sort of value judgment to it, but understanding it as a natural process of some sort.
Exactly. And his feeling was that was a more reliable way to find peace and to be able to deal with life. Because, you know, a lot of times he thought prediction was totally possible. There was not a problem with that necessarily, but of course you can't predict things exactly. And any astrologer will tell you that you can't predict things exactly. So he said that, you know, you have to be careful with prediction, because fear and anticipation, you can stir these up in a client, and that can cause problems. And he felt it was a more reliable way to just be able to see the cyclic nature of things and to get a wider perspective, because there's all kinds of things that happen in life that we don't choose, but they happen anyway. So he was really advocating a way to reframe things, to see them as something that's necessary, You know, and one of his favorite sayings was, we must learn to use crisis, since crisis is going to happen anyway. I mean, no matter how good your predictive skills are, you're still going to have crises in your life.
Right. And it's probably like the difference, just thinking about his biography, between focusing in on like making a prediction, like looking at his birth chart and saying, I don't know, like, you know, your father will die at an early age when you're 16 years old versus, you know, you'll go through a difficult period at the age of 16, but it will force you to make a change in your life that will lead you on this trajectory ultimately that will be positive or constructive or conducive to your overall life direction. And it will be a change in trajectory at this point that will be challenging, but then will result in whatever later on.
Absolutely. And, you know, the example of losing his kidney and adrenal gland at age 11, well, that's certainly a problem. But on the other hand, it kept him out of the French army.
Sure. So a large part of his work, he's really one of the first early 20th century astrologers to really get into that process of trying to reframe things and moving away from ideas of just good and bad or framing things completely as like benefic or malefic, but instead trying to look at it as a overall like process, almost oriented approach in some sense.
Right, right. Very good. Yes. And he had some things, I guess, you know, I guess I'd call them Rudyard's prime concerns. You know, and he said that the chart, the astrological chart, was a seed pattern. And of course, what a seed is a bunch of potentials. Okay, this seed is a potential oak tree or an acorn and an oak. And that there's a lot of things that can happen that can help the potential manifest itself. And he called this the process of self-actualization. And that's what he thought astrology really was for. It was for to help you be everything that you could be. So he was looking at the chart in ways of, you know, finding what gifts there were and how to bring them out. And, you know, he was more interested in the best ways to grow, you know, the best ways to become happy. And this is really much more his focus than anything else. And he would come up, as you mentioned, looking beyond the concept of good and bad. He called it sometimes the way of the sage. You know, that you would have Stoic sages, Buddhist sages, Taoist sages. They all say the same thing. They say that you have to accept life's tragedies and difficulties along with the good things. And you really can't choose. He called this the mind of the sage, the way of the sage, to be able to put things in context. One of his most interesting ways of expressing something, he said, we have to bear in mind that there's a difference between structure and content. Because he's kind of talking about fate and free will and what's predictable and what isn't predictable. So he said the birth chart lays out a structure, you know, the dates of transits, you know, the difficult squares or configurations in your natal chart. These are things that won't change. They're structurally in your chart. But he said that you can choose the content of what you fill yourself with, you know, that you can react to things with anger, resentment, revenge, or judgment. But you can also choose another path. You can choose to approach things with acceptance, compassion, forgiveness, all those kind of things. And almost anybody would agree that that's a healthier way to go, the second set of choices.
Sure. So that this becomes the, you know, in later generations of astrologers that were influenced by Rudyard, like in Richard Tarnas's archetypal astrology, where he says that astrology is not concretely predictive, but it's archetypally predictive. And so, like you're saying, Rudyard would say that it's predetermined that you're going to have X Saturn transit when you're, let's say you're going to have your Saturn return between the ages of 27 and 30, but how you deal with and respond to that there's a range of possible manifestations that would fit that archetype, that have, you know, different possibilities. And it could be on the more positive end of the spectrum, or it could be more challenging. It's not necessarily given that you're going to have one particular manifestation, but that there's some element of choice or free will in terms of how that ends up manifesting, and that's partially up to you.
Right, right. And Rudyard would love that statement from Richard Tarnas. I mean, that would be, he would really like that. And, you know, a lot of this would be in response to the as Rudyard would say, the content that you filled yourself up with would have something to do with how this all goes for you. That's what he would say. He had a beautiful, he had two analogies that he used a lot, and they're really good. He was talking about a glass of water. He's talking about structure. He says, so if you have a glass of water, it has a certain shape, and it could be filled with water or wine or poison. He said, you don't drink the glass, you drink the water. And this was the way he expressed the idea of a multivalent archetype. He never came up with the word multivalent archetype, but this is exactly what he meant by what you fill the glass with.
Sure. So and this became part of this overall, these other terms I think that you use or that he used, like the path of transformation and things like that, right?
Exactly. Yes. And you know, what do you use astrology for? He viewed it as, well, at one point in the astrology of personality, he called astrology the alchemy of personality. And he talked a lot, especially in his later philosophical works, about what he called the path of transformation, which, you know, it turns out to be a very ancient way of thinking. I mean, the Hermeticists had this also in their path, the idea of a path of transformation, a path of purification. And actually, in a lot of that, Rudyard was surprisingly Hermetic. You know, he would very much, you know, the idea in Hermeticism of progressing through the spheres, you know, at each sphere, you would have to lose the negativity of each of those planets all the way up. And that's the path of transformation. And that's very much what Rudyard was advocating.
Okay. So what are some other, sort of moving on, what are some other key concepts from Rudyard's thinking that are kind of like recurring themes?
The unity of opposites is something that goes through all of his work. And this is an ancient thought. This goes back to the pre-Socratics. I guess it was Heraclides, the first person who talked about it. But the idea that things that appear to be opposite, if you go down deep enough, you start finding themes that connect them and things. And there's a certain, he really found the Tai Chi symbol, the yin yang symbol, to be something that he got a lot of use out of that for explaining things. In The Pulse of Life, he explained the whole zodiac by this interplay of day force and night force. And in fact, that's a big piece of rigorous thinking, you know, day force and night force. That there's a force that wants to individualize things, which is the day force, and the night force that wants to collectivize things. And life was this constant interplay of these two things. And that's, you know, a major theme that I could point to. And another major theme is the whole idea of the harmonizing of Eastern and Western paths. And this is something he got originally from Blavatsky, because that was a strong part of, or at least the best side of theosophy, okay, was that kind of teaching. But really the rest of his life was about doing that, you know, embracing and learning about the philosophies of Sri Aurobindo and some other, you know, modern European thinkers, Teilhard de Chardin and people like that. So he was continuing to do his own synthesis after theosophy, but that got him on that kind of path.
Sure, sure.
Another big, big theme was the whole issue of fate and free will. And he did a really great talk that's available on the internet on fate and free will. It was amazing. He called fate and free will the central hang-up of Western civilization. He said it's because we get it confused. We get it confused with the rights of the individual. And he thought there was so much confusion around this topic. And he thought the whole question was a false dichotomy to begin with, fate and free will. You know, he always explained it as the yin-yang symbol, that every situation has a certain balance of fate and free will in it. And it's never one or the other. And they would kind of flow into each other. So, you know, there are some situations that seem to have a lot more predetermined elements to it, but it's never totally predetermined. And then the opposite is never true either. You're never in a situation where it's, you know, it's all free will. So, and this is a nuanced thing that a lot of people don't get. You know, this is a very nuanced discussion he had.
Sure. And something he returned to many times in his works.
Many times, you know, from beginning to end. You know, in the end, he had a very nice saying that probably I've heard elsewhere, but, you know, change what you can, but accept what you must. And that sounds like a pretty healthy kind of a statement.
Sure, sure. All right. And so let's see, other either key topics or other themes as we're getting...
I guess one last thing I guess I'd mention is he's very well known for the idea of karma, you know, and this goes straight across to evolutionary astrology right now too. But he talked a lot in terms of karma. But he was really aware that that could be tricky. You know, and he would say this, I can't tell you how many times, a lot of times, he could, karma should never be seen as an individual matter. You know, there are many collective levels of karma. There's individual karma, family karma, group karma, national karma. The planet itself has a certain level of karma. And all of these things interact. And so you have to understand that, you know, the idea of karma makes you take some responsibility for your actions, but to realize that you don't have control, really. I mean, there's all kinds of larger forces at work. And some of those you just have to accept. And he was also aware of the possibility of blaming the victim or using karma as some kind of bludgeon. And it seemed like he was really concerned because he kept coming back to it. He was always very careful on these questions. I think that's an important thing to mention.
Right, just because, you know, like one of the concerns, one of the things I've raised more recently about how some of those, the direction that some of those sort of philosophies in modern astrology has gone is that sometimes you can accidentally potentially end up like blaming the victim if you attribute too much control over everything to them and things like that. But one of your points is that Rudyard was actually very careful to try to avoid that or to be aware of that as a potential and to have a much more nuanced discussion than sometimes the discussions today are.
Absolutely. That's exactly why I'd want to be sure that people knew that. That wasn't not his attitude.
Sure. Okay. So, and we're sort of running out of time, so I want to make sure we touch on a few other things. One of them is just, you said he was a major pioneer in the study of the cycles and the importance of the outer planets, right?
Right. Yeah, he did. He's probably the person who most, well, he has lots of books and articles explaining, you know, the long-term outer planetary patterns and how that plays out. And probably before anybody else was doing that, I haven't done a lot of research into who was doing this ahead of time, but, he wrote a book called Astrological Timing back in the early 70s. It's just an amazing look at basically all of history through the lens of Neptune and Pluto. And he did a lot of work that way. In fact, that would be an interesting topic sometime.
Sure.
Not really that prepared at the moment to go through it, but that was a big thing for him. And you know, within a couple of years of Pluto being discovered, Rudyard described Pluto in ways that sound exactly the way people are describing it now, especially in evolutionary astrology circles. I mean, he was right on it. I'm not quite sure how he got on that so quick.
So he ends up then being not just potentially a sort of foundational author in terms of how the nodes are conceptualized in modern times, but potentially one of the foundational people in terms of crafting and sort of coming up with or setting the initial foundation for how Pluto is interpreted.
Really, for all of the outer planets, from a much more modern perspective, I think you could look back to his writings for that and find lots of precedent there for how a lot of people are talking about them now.
Sure. All right. And then one of the other things that he's really known for is his work on the specific technique that he's known for is his work on the lunation cycle and a specific book that he wrote on that topic, right?
Right. And the lunation cycle, the book that we know now came out in 1967, but it had been written during, half of the book was written during World War II. And he published it as a small book called The Moon. And it didn't sell that many. It sold 1,000 copies or so and then went out of print because the publisher stopped covering astrology books. So he got back during the mid 60s. This was one of the flood of books that came out from him. And it's been very, very influential called the lunation cycle. A lot of people use the techniques. And we don't have lots of time, but basically in this, he goes through kind of a new way of looking at the moon, looking at the progressed moon in relation to the progressed sun. And people had really been using progressions in terms of looking at progressed planets to just natal planets. And this was a new way of looking how this cycle played out in the 90 days after you're born, this lunation cycle. And so he used the concept of an 8-phase system for the progressed sun and the progressed moon, or actually in someone's natal chart, you know, what are the angles between the sun and the moon? And he laid out 8 different types of, really more than personality types, they're more of a dynamic relationship. You know, the idea that someone born during a new moon has got a different type of dynamic in their personality than someone that was born at the first quarter. You know, new moon people tend to be very charismatic. They operate subjectively, somewhat unconsciously, but there's a certain kind of archetypal power to new moon people. And first quarter people, for instance, you know, they struggle more. They confront resistance. They tend to confront problems more directly. There are certain kinds of personality dynamics you can see. And a full moon type is quite different. So there was this whole descriptive element of what he called the solilunar types. And it's really fascinating. And we don't have time to go into it, but Demetra George does a beautiful article on her website describing the 8 solilunar types. And she uses these techniques pretty extensively from what I can see in terms of natal delineations and then in terms of using the progressed cycle itself to see how that plays out over life. And, you know, I just for a really kind of a quick example, I took a look at your chart.
Okay.
And you had a progressed new moon, lunation new moon in December of 2005.
Yes, I remember that well. That's when I discovered, that's right in the sort of start of my focus on Hellenistic astrology. And I just moved out to the translation project where I spent 2 years studying Hellenistic texts. And within a year of having my progressed new moon, I started writing my book on Hellenistic astrology.
Right. And according to this theory, during the progressed new moon phase, certain seeds that were from previous cycles start germinating. Okay. And there's a new idea created at the new moon, but you don't know what it is yet. It doesn't really have a name, but it starts growing and it starts gathering some interest. So you have this new moon that started in the first degree of Sagittarius. So we could say there was a Sagittarian logos, a Sagittarian mission, maybe. So you had your crescent phase in 2009. And usually this is when an idea starts getting clearer. You have some idea what it is and you start developing it. And there's some kind of resistance, but the idea is growing. And it goes to the first quarter, which is a crisis point. And you hit that in 2013. And the idea in the first quarter is you meet resistance. There's some kind of reality testing. Reality is trying to tell you need to adjust or what you're doing is correct. And you're building some strength by dealing with resistance. And sometimes people's projects fall apart at this point. Reality testing indicates that things you need course correction. But it's this time of crisis. And then you entered the gibbous phase, which is just before the full moon this month, actually. And what that means is, the time of resistance is not so much resistance. You start during the gibbous phase, you start cooperating more. You start making alliances. Whatever it is that was developing is fully along. It's fully in progress and it goes through its stages. And that's a 4-year period. Actually, you're starting now and you're in a full moon lunation phase in 2021. And the full moon phase, you know, is a time of potential blossoming, realization, things coming full circle. Now, that depends on what you've been planting. I mean, if you haven't been doing good work, if you've been planting weeds, that's what's going to flower. And so whatever flowers during that new moon period depends on the work that was done. But that's the basic kind of a phase. Now, as the cycle moves on, you know, you start having bearing fruit, giving things away, and you start creating the seeds for your next cycle. So this whole lunation cycle lasts about 29 and a half years. And everybody jumps in at a different point. Depends on, you know, were you born during a new moon, full moon? So it's not like the Saturn return where everybody has it at the same time. It's going to be different timing for everybody.
Right. That's a really good introduction to this sort of cycle or process-oriented approach of Rudyard, because it just shows that you have to look at everything not just as a singular moment in time, but relative to these broader cycles and like where you're coming from and where you're headed and where you're at in the broader cycle of things.
Right, exactly. That illustrates it perfectly.
Yeah. So in the lunation book, it's, as you said, it's both each person in their natal chart has a specific lunar phase that they're born in, and each phase has its own specific qualities and characteristics which will imprint the life. And it's basically a cycle that's broken up into eight parts, right? So you have the you have the initial four quadrants that are established by the new moon, the full moon, and the first quarter and second quarter moon. And so that breaks it into four sections in between those. And then in the middle points of those, you break those in half, which then breaks it up into eight sections, basically, right?
Right. Yeah. So as I said, there's Stephen Forrest did an excellent book that really, really goes into depth on the solely lunar types. And Rudyard was always careful to call it solely lunar because the moon doesn't have any phases. It's phases in relationship to the sun. So in that book, he covers that, and he covers the progressed cycle that we talked about. He has some interesting chapters on the part of fortune, part of spirit. Those are really worth reading. I think people would find it really quite interesting, but it's a really good first book to get into. The writing is very clear. There's techniques that you can immediately use, and just historically too. That would be the place I would tell people they may want to start if they want to read something by Rudyard.
Yeah, definitely. The lunation cycle book. And then, as you said, Dimitra George has some great stuff on the lunation cycle as a technique as well, which she originally learned studying Rudyard's works. She's talked about, I think we talked about in the episode where we talked about her life and work, how she was about to graduate from college and get a degree as a math teacher, but then she decided to run off to a commune and join a commune in the late 1960s. And there was a bunch of astrology books, and some of the books that she read were Rudyard's books. And she, one of the techniques that she took and used and really developed was sort of Rudyard's approach to the lunation cycle. So if you do a search on Google for like Dimitra George lunation phase, at the very top, you'll find an article titled The Lunation Cycle by Dimitra George that has some great illustrations and graphics and a pretty straightforward approach to understanding the eight lunation phases, both in terms of, you know, what phase you have in your natal chart, as well as how you can use that as the timing technique within the context of secondary progressions, which is what you were talking about earlier.
Right, right. Yeah, she does quite a bit of work with that technique and seems to integrate it very well with the rest of her practice.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's see. So other than that, I mean, where else in terms of accessing Rudyard's work and different resources for learning more about him, what is available to people?
I would recommend the most incredible resource is something called the Rudyard Audio Archives. And this is maintained by Nikki Michaels, who's a great San Francisco astrologer. She was very close to Rudyard in his last 10 years. She's probably the astrologer closest to him. And she's got about 22 hours of recorded talks. And these talks are just beautiful. I mean, they're so concise. They're so clear. He's got this wonderful French accent that takes a few minutes to get used to. But once you're used to it, it's wonderful.
And these are from like the 1960s forward, right?
Right. The earliest one is from 1960. So he was already, you know, he was already 65 and older. And some of these, you know, he's obviously losing some vigor, but they're so clear. It's just really powerful stuff. He's got things on astrology of self-actualization, fate and free will, all kinds of interesting topics. And the way he handles them is there's no wasted words in these, and they're it's really a compact way. And I found after listening to all of these that I was able to just read the books so much more easily because his thought patterns and language patterns were in my head. So, you know, if I pick up his reading now, I go, how could that have seemed hard before? It seems easy now. So I'd really recommend that. And thank you, Nikki, for doing that. There's also a website called Kaldea.com. And I'll provide some links for this. And that would be nice for people to have. It's got hundreds of articles from Rudyard out of the thousands that he wrote, or 1,200 or something. They have a lot of articles. And it's got a bunch of out-of-print books. It's got an illustrated biography. It's a tremendous resource. I've used that a lot over the last 12 years since it's come online. It's wonderful. He's got about 8 of his books that are still mostly astrology books in print from Aurora Press. As I said, a lot of them are available on Kaldea. The books I mentioned the lunation cycle as a great place to start, but also the Pulse of Life. Even if you don't get very far with Rudyard, if you read the Pulse of Life, it's his vision of the signs, and it's just excellent. He also, late in his life, became aware that he wanted to write a short, simple book for people that would have a lot of his teachings. And he wrote a book called Astrological Insights into the Spiritual Life. It's kind of an unwieldy title, but the book is just beautiful, very thin. And it basically goes through the signs and the houses. And it's just inspiring. It's really beautiful. And I guess the last work I'd recommend any of them, but he wrote a book called Astrological Aspects. And he wrote that with his wife, Layla. And it's probably the best treatment of aspects that I've seen. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good book on aspects. So those are some of the ones, and those are all still, most of those are still available through Aurora Press, right?
Lunation Cycle, Astrological Insights, Astrological Aspects, those are available through Aurora. And The Pulse of Life, which really should be put out again as a regular book, but it's, you can access it through Kaldea. And I would love to see that come out as an ebook or a Kindle book. That would be great.
Sure. But in the meantime, you can find it at kaldea.com.
Right. Right. And I'm thinking over the next couple of years, we're going to see some projects to try to pull together because he still has a lot of work that isn't in print, a lot of things that was never published. So I think we'll see some projects that we'll try to correct that.
Sure. Yeah, especially with some of the growing awareness and sort of looking back at his work. And, you know, it's interesting because he initially branded his astrology in the early part of his career as humanistic astrology, or that's partially what he called it. And then later in his career, he started calling it transpersonal astrology, right?
Right. He felt that the humanistic astrology thing had kind of gone full circle. And basically, you know, people were just getting too self-involved. My problems, my complexes. So he took it in a more spiritual direction. And, you know, his last book on astrology was published in 1980. It's called The Astrology of Transformation. And, you know, that's really where he talks most directly about that. But transpersonal astrology, actually, it's said that he came up with that word first, transpersonal. I don't know if that's true, but there's a number of words he may have coined.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, I think that starts to bring us to the end of this. And so you have done, and you've given talks, and you continue to give talks and lectures and workshops and other teachings on Rudyard's work as well as other things, right?
Yes. Yes, and I want to keep doing that. I have some Rudyard projects in mind. But if people want to know anything about consultations or talks or classes for me, it's a CZ Astrology, the letter C, Z, and astrology.com.
Okay, so your initials and then astrology.com?
Right, right.
Perfect. And I think you're giving a talk at the end of this month for your local group, aren't you?
Right. I'm giving it on the moon. It's called How Deep is the Moon? And it's basically about the lunation cycle, the secondary progress moon, new moon before birth, the node, really the whole lunar complex of symbols. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Excellent. And that's for which group is that for again?
It's for the NCGR group in Sacramento. And it's a talk I'll be developing. I hope to give it elsewhere too.
Okay, excellent. Well, yeah, people should check that out, and they should check out your website at czastrology.com.
Yes, great.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it, Chet. I think we were able to, in our second, you know, attempt to record this episode, I think we were able to cover most of the same bases that we covered last time, maybe slightly, well, a little bit more tired than we were the first time around, but I'm glad that we did this. So thanks for coming and helping me to do it again this time.
Well, thank you. This is great. I really appreciate your show, and congratulations on your book. It's just beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. And I'm glad, you know, we've been planning this episode for a long time, or we've been wanting to do it and wanting to record an episode on Rudyard. And it took us a while to eventually get it together. And then it's funny how many sort of obstacles we ran into in the process, but I think we did it, and we accomplished what we set out to do. And hopefully those little annoying obstacles still made us end up with something that was better than what we might have had otherwise.
I think so. Actually, I think it did turn out better.
All right. Excellent. Well, thanks again for joining me.
Okay. Well, thank you. Bye-bye, Chris.
All right. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.